I have no idea what I'm going to do, but I know New Mexico probably won't be glad I'm there in a few more months, you know. I have not the foggiest idea what I'm going to do, but I know it's not nothing. And when I see that man today in the mirror, God, I like him. Because I used to hate people that were like that. My best friend used to be like that, or he's still like, God, he used to piss me off. I mean, he really had a strong social consciousness, and they used to just burn my ass. I mean, we used to argue. I mean, I would be voting for Reagan, and he would be voting for the independent, you know? I mean, it's like, we would just, God, it was war, always, you know? And he could see the plight, and he could understand, feel the pain, and he couldn't let it go, you know? And I used to hate him for it, because I knew, and the only reason I hated him for it is because I knew, I did not know that what I knew was that I, too, was the same person, and I wasn't in touch with that person. So it had nothing to do with my not being like them. I don't hate people I'm not like. I hate people I'm like. People I'm not like, I don't have any time for. I don't bother there. What do you think of Bill? Bill who? He's been sitting next to you for 4 years in the meeting. Shit, I don't know, Bill. What's he look like? Yeah. I don't even know they're there. I hate people I'm like. See? People I'm like. And they may be good people, gentle people, conscious people. And the only reason I'm angry is because there's a part of me dying because I'm not in touch with that person. Yeah. So the adult, I love him. He's going to create a lot of interesting energy in my life, you know, from all sources. But part of freedom and part of spirituality, as I understand it, there was an old guy in AA. His wife died when he was 50 years old. And he began to drink at 50 years of age. He had not drank before. He drank for 10 years, from 50 to 60, and at 60 he landed on Skid Row. He continued to drink and live on Skid Row for 10 more years. He was a Skid Row drunk until he was 70. He came into AA when he was 70 years old. He obtained and maintained 14 years of sobriety. He lived to be 84 years of age. And when he died, he was like more prepared to go than most people I know are to live. I mean, he wanted his funeral on Saturday, so all the responsible AAs with jobs would come. He had arranged for Chuck C. to give the eulogy, but he had left notes of stuff he wanted him to talk about. I mean, he was ready, it was time. And he had left his own little thing that he wanted read. And this guy summed up his 84 years of life, including the 50 years without drinking and the 20 years of alcoholism, the 10 years on Skid Row, and the 14 years of recovery, with this. He said, it comes to this. Know yourself. Know yourself. Not other people's perception of you. Know yourself. Be yourself. Give of yourself. So part of this process is finding out who you are. Not creating something new. That ain't what's here. That's not what this is about. It's not what the program's designed for. It's not what any decent spiritual path in the world is constructed for. It is not about constructing a new person. It's finding the person that you are. That person is okay, and then be that person. And you know what the number one resistance to that is? That you know you'll lose your friends. There is an instinct in you that says, if I do that, I will lose my friends, and the instinct is correct. You will. For as you begin to change, people must change with you, move on the path with you, or be left. Be left. There is no nobility in staying in a pig pen. There's no nobility in staying in a non-supportive, destructive environment once you begin to find out who you are. And sometimes, in finding out who you are, guess what? You might make a mistake. So what? I loved what people said. We're just here to learn. You cannot fail. You can't. So what if you try a new job and you don't like it? Big deal. You know? Big
deal. You find another one. You try something else. You find out who you are. Because I got to tell you, it's in a tremendous sense finding out who I am. And all of it isn't, you know, like, look, I also wanted the personalities as an adolescent. Guy's a pain in the ass. I mean, the adolescent is a killer. You know, he's hip, slick, and cool, right? You know, always looking good. Guys, you all know who he is, right? He's the one who gives you whiplash driving down the street. You know, he cruises to high school if he wasn't afraid he'd get caught, you know, in a 50-year-old body driving by the high school. He's a kid, you know, he's a teenager, man. That's all he is, and that's how he thinks. I take bears on airplanes, and the adolescent can't stand it. Particularly if it's a big bear, it takes up a whole seat, you know. Oh, he goes nuts, because he wants to sleep with the stewardess. You know, that's all he knows about. See? And he thinks the only way he's going to get to sleep with a stewardess is look good, and the last goddamn way he's ever going to look good is with a big teddy bear sitting in his seat next to him. He goes right off the fucking map. You know, he goes, oh, no, that's a bear. No, not in the seat next. Put the goddamn bear in the baggage compartment where he belongs. Get him out of the seat. Not in the seat. Please, not in the seat. He goes right over the edge. I just have to calm him down and tell him we don't want anything to do with anybody that doesn't like teddy bears. You know, and even that's still not acceptable, by the way. He still just sits in the plane, you know, and he just has a rotten trip. I remember one time I was getting rid of a car, and the adolescent came to me and said, I want a Corvette. And I said, oh, God, I don't know. I don't like Corvettes. Oh, man, he said, God, they're great. I mean, they're low and they're sleek. And he says, oh, you look so good in a Corvette. He's got a Corvette. It's just, he said, it's the car. I said, I look silly in a Corvette. Oh, man, we got to have a Corvette. We got to have a Corvette. I says, oh, I don't know. I thought about it for a couple of days, you know. When I came back to the adolescent, I said, you know what? I really love you. And you never had a car that you didn't steal. You know? And that's sad, you know? I said, that's sad. So you know what we're going to do? We're going to take you out and we're going to buy you a Corvette. And I took him out and I got him a Corvette. And he loved it. But we had a few problems between the child and the adolescent and with the car. Because children in cars are like small dogs, you know? They like to hang their head out the window and, you know, they don't care, right? And so the child always wanted the T-roof off the car. Always. Because the child wants the wind and the sky and all that, you know, it's like, you know how kids are, right? But the adolescent has got to look good when he gets where he's going. He can't stand my hair. He used to be a lot longer than he can't stand for his hair to be blown. So he wants the T-roof on, the windows up, you know, the frosted windows up, and the air conditioner on, right? Because he wants to get out of the car looking good. You know? He does not want to look like he's just been through a goddamn wind tunnel, right? So I bought a hairbrush and a water spray bottle for the adolescent, so the kid could have the T-roof off when we drove somewhere, and the adolescent could fix his hair when he got there. You know, it was the best I could do. We ran into a small problem, however, with the adolescent. The Corvette, in that they are designed for speed. And he somehow could not contain himself, went set loose on the freeway system of Southern California. And I began to become acquainted with a lot of highway patrol officers throughout the state. Nice guys. They write fast, but nice guys. And the last one, I think I forget how fast I was going on Highway 5 in Kalinga, near Kalinga, and got nailed. And the Department of Motor Vehicles sent me a letter saying, you've had too many. You've gone too fast on our highways too many times. And my insurance company sent me a letter saying, we're done with you. You know, your insurance is now going from super safe driver discount, whatever it was, minimal money, to like, you know, $4,000 more for the year.
So I said to the adolescent, contain yourself. Actually, I'd said to him, contain yourself before the last ticket. I got the last ticket, and I got rid of the car. A loving parent, though, you see. I gave him his chance, and I gave him what he wanted, and he couldn't be responsible with it. So I took it away. You see? But it was a good experience. It was a real good experience. And the thing I'm trying to convey here is these are all part of me, and if they're all part of me, they're all part of God. So it's not to hate yourself. It's not to hate the child. It's not to hate this adolescent's behavior. I mean, I know guys, well, I don't know about the girls, but I know with the guys, I know, God, that behavior can get really frustrating. You know, I mean, to be behaving like a fucking 15-year-old and you're in a grown adult male, you know, it's like, oh, Jesus, it makes me mad. You know, I mean, I can even see cars, you know, and the street are like kids' cars. I wouldn't own it on a bet. But the adolescent gets crazy. Exactly what we need. I communicate with me oftentimes through the bears. That's why, if you wonder why I am a promoter of stuffed animals, sometimes I can't talk to God for one reason or another, but I can talk to the bears. And the bears talk back. The bears convey to me truths that I need to know. Truths that I already know that I need to, you know, acknowledge. That's maybe better put. So oftentimes the bears will tell me things that I need to know, you know. This little guy who's with me, the Santa Fe bear, is a great bear because he's a protector. You know, he comes with me to protect me to get me back to Santa Fe safe. Well, okay, what is that? That is just very simply, I live alone, I'm in Santa Fe, and I don't know anybody there. I know, you know, I'm getting to know people like real fast, but it's not like my best friend is leaving to live in Europe for a year, you know, so I mean there's like a lot of separation going on. And there was a separation just took place. This little bear is like my way of communicating to me that I care about me and I want me to get back home safe. Okay? And because of this nature of this communication, the bears have requests. And the request must be honored. Now, I find that most of the requests the bears make of me are things that I was never allowed as a child. The bears want to do. So, when the Olympics came along, the bears all wanted to watch the Olympics. All the bears. And at the time, I was in a relationship with a girl from Canada, so we had some Canadian bears, too. Right? And they also wanted to watch. They weren't particularly interested in rooting for the U.S., but they did want to watch because they wanted to root for Canada. So during the 2 weeks that the Olympics were on, or however long it was, I had gotten all, if you came into my apartment when I wasn't home, forget when I was home. When I wasn't home, if the manager had come in, she'd had a goddamn heart attack, I'm sure. Because in the living room, I had about 3/4 of the bears all lined up on the couch in the love seat, and all in a big circle with TV on, with the Olympics on. And the Canadian bears had little Canadian flags and Canadian hats, and, you know, all that stuff. And then in the other bedroom was the rest of the bears, all in a, you know, half moon circle on the bed with the TV on in the bedroom, watching the Olympics from there. And they loved the Olympics. They had a wonderful time. They cheered and they just loved the Olympics. They just had a great time. I personally was destroyed by the Olympics. I probably went through, it's safe to say, somewhere between 12 and 20 boxes of tissues during the Olympics. And the reason it was so emotional for me was this process of getting in front of these little people that live inside of you has a lot of side effects and feeling things for other people, identifying with the feeling and experiencing it yourself. So I would watch the Olympics And some guy would come out, you know, and they would do like a profile before he'd participate in the event. And one kid, you know, they were talking to him before the event, and they were saying to him, you know, he talked about how hard he worked and how much time he'd put in and how important it was to him and the focus he had put on it. And I mean, it was real nice listening to the kid. And then he went out and he participated in the event, whatever it was, and won. And I just broke down and sobbed. Because I've always been afraid to say, I can, I want, I need, let me try. Because I always have the added voice that say, you will fail, forget it. Okay? And he had done, came and tried and did and won. And another incident, which is really heavy, really heavy. They interviewed one of the kids before, one of the swimmers before, who was recognized as like, you know, one of the best. And he had missed the preceding Olympics because of the Carter decision. And he had hung on and trained for 4 more years and came back. And they interviewed him before the event. And he's not only did he plan on winning, okay, he also planned on breaking the world's record. I mean, and he stated that very clearly to the press and to the TV guys. No bullshit, you know. I mean, forget the competition, man. I'm here to win. I'm here to break the world's record, okay? He swam in the event. He won the event. He broke the Olympic record. He failed to break the world record by a matter of fractions of seconds. And when they put the camera on him and the event was over and he turned and he looked at the clock, he was visibly disappointed. He was upset. And, you know, they got him out of the pool and they got him back in the press tent and they interviewed him right after the event. And he wasn't fucking thrilled, you know? He wasn't waving flags and all yahoo. He was bummed out. And he had said he was upset. And he was disappointed, you know? And he walked off. And to show you why you're having a little trouble with recovery, the American press, sports writers, beat this kid up so bad that he had to come back the next day and apologize on fucking television for being a human being. Now, let me explain something to you. To go out there and say, I am here to participate, I am here to win, I am here to break the world's record, to fail and to be disappointed is to be human. What he did was emotional health. The example he gave the world was somebody who wasn't afraid to take a chance and disappointed when he didn't succeed. And now you want to know why you have trouble finding out who the hell you are and being that person? This is on a global level. He took the chance. You know? I'd like to meet his parents. I'd like to meet his parents. Because they're responsible for the kid that could take that risk, who wasn't afraid to say, hey, here's what I'm going to do, and blew it. And also wasn't afraid to say, shit. You know? God. Because he had to wait another 4 years to do it. And then he got a kid on, and he interviewed him about his event. And he told him his mother and father had ridden from, like, Michigan on a motorcycle to come watch him participate in the Olympics. And I broke my heart. Because I was so happy for him that they had done that. And I had to experience my sadness. I had to experience every goddamn open house at school that nobody came. Any time a pissant sporting thing prior to high school, which by then I gave up, that I participated in, like the Junior Olympics in the Coliseum, and nobody came, you know? And their parents came, you know? It's just like, wow, the Olympics were an experience. And the kid who had cancer, the wrestler, anybody see him? Man had Hodgkin's disease, he told him he was going to die. And he says, he's going to be in the Olympics. He won. And broke down and sobbed uncontrollably while being interviewed on television. Didn't look cool. Didn't care. Okay? Didn't care. He was who he was. You know? And it's not, see, God's plan, as I understand it, is not for me to reconstruct. Thank you very much. Reconstruct me. It is to be me. We spend all our goddamn time confined, restrained, contained, constructing a new person instead of being who you already are. And you know what? All the effort goes into not being who we are. That's where all your fucking energy's going. That's the fight. That's the whole battle you're putting up. Is not being who you are. Trying to be something else. Trying to get other people's approval. Trying to keep the peace. Trying to not rock the boat. You know, we're great at that one. I'd like you to know that I can't stand that, but I don't want to rock the boat. So I'll get a stiff neck and thing and won't say anything. I don't want you to see who I am. Who I am. Who am I? I'm a child of God. Created in His image and likeness. I must be okay. Why am I working so hard? And you know what? My experience is starting to validate. I'm fine. All these horrible fears about this inept, terrible, worthless person that I was were unfounded, ungrounded, and unreal. I'm a terrific guy. You know, and I'm not what I thought I was, and I'm not who a lot of people would like me to be, and I'm certainly not what my family would like me to be, you know. I mean, ever since I became a writer, I've never been what they wanted me to be, particularly when I'm in a dry spell and those money's coming in. That's always, when are you going to get a real job, you know? That's why my friend is moving, my dearest friend is moving to France, you know? He says, you know, fuck it, I'm broke here, you know, and I'm tired of people, you know, looking at me like I'm some kind of, Martian from another goddamn planet, and when am I going to go get a real job? Because he's a recognized expert on adolescence and alcoholism, which is something he chooses not to do, you know? And he says, at least, goddamn it, in France, you know, you're respected if you're a writer. You know, he's got 11 books published. It's not like he's some kind of complete absolute person, you know, with 3,000 manuscripts stacked in the corner that have never gone anywhere. And I love him for it. He's saying, well, I want people to, you know. So he says, what do you do? I say, I'm a writer. He says, I want them, you know, to hug me, kiss me, offer me a glass of wine. You know, I won't drink it, you know, but just acknowledge that it's a great thing that I do, create, you know. And I thought, wow, you know, I mean, that's what it's about here, guys. And instead of being, oh, I'll stay here and tough it out. Okay, maybe I will get another job. Maybe this is wrong, you know, maybe. God, wrong. What a terrible word, wrong. Didn't know this meeting was going to go this long. If I had a magic wand, I'd go through the room and touch each one of you and let you know that you're fine. You're just fine. I mean, that would be my wish. If I could draw a spirit into the room from the other side who could grant you a wish, it would be that you would know that you're fine. Yeah. That would be the wish. Let's talk about the move. I was really stuck for a couple years in L.A. I was at the wall. I had a terrible time for a couple years. I was forced into bankruptcy. And it was like, I could not get off the wall. And I had the tools, and I knew, but to get off the wall meant some real serious change. I mean, I was also aware that to leave the wall I was on meant, you know, big change. Eventually, it came down a couple months ago, 3 months ago, whenever it was, that I wasn't going to talk about this. It's interesting that I'm going to. And I'll tell you why it's interesting that I'm going to. It means that I feel I'm in a safe environment. Which makes me feel real good. Because I talk a lot of places, I do not particularly feel like I'm in a safe environment. I remember the 50th anniversary of AA in Seattle when they were screaming back at me from the audience. Somehow I didn't get the feeling that they were delighted I was the speaker. You know, they wanted to all fucking reminisce over how wonderful AA was doing. And I said, God, if we're doing so good, how come we're losing so many after 5 years? And the talk just sort of seemed to go downhill from there. I can't understand why. So about 3 months ago, I guess I knew I was going to have to get off the wall. And I knew to get off the wall, I was going to have to move. I mean move. It meant separation. It meant move. It meant me move somewhere away, far away. And in my mind said to me, well, we'll move to Washington.
There's the San Juan Islands off the coast of Washington, and there's a writer's colony there. There's Bach and some others who are up there. You can go live there. You have friends there who will house you and feed you and look after you, who would be delighted to have you there. People had made the offer. Please come stay with us, you know. And people I enjoy, people who are nutritionally conscious bicyclists, you know, people who are, a couple of friends who, in fact, just bicycled from Seattle to Newport for, you know, their vacation, for something to do. And I don't know why I got to tell this, but I have a need to tell this. It's interesting because it's about being yourself. The girl's on the program and her husband isn't. He's an Alana. And he's a chef. He's the number two chef at a 5-star hotel in Seattle. Neat guy. God, he's the most gentle soul I've ever met. But yet a very, you know, powerful guy in his way. But he's beautiful. He's a real gentle soul. And what he does is cook. And what he does is cook really well. And he likes to eat really good food. And that's who he is. So when they bicycle and tour, he has no fucking intentions of eating dehydrated, dried anything, right? And because he's a strong guy and a powerful cyclist, he carries with him his necessary pots, pans, cutting board, cleaver, that he needs to fix a meal. And he says, you know, when I hit a campground, the resentment is staggering, right? Because everybody else is putting heated water in their package, and he's out there, you know, with the vegetables and the cutting board and the fish slicing and the skillets and the stirring and the herbs, you know, and the spices and the brown rice, you know, on the thing and fixing their meal. Okay? And the reason I'm sharing that story is he has no compunction against being who he is. So while everybody else in the campground is roughing it and doing it their way, Paul is who he is. And it doesn't bother him a bit. And it doesn't. He gets out his stuff and he does his stuff. And of course, Kit loves it because it's, you know, all that time she doesn't have to deal with the kitchen while they're gone. Anyhow, so Washington. I'm going to move to Washington. So I go to New Mexico to speak at a convention. And I'm there for the weekend. And Lois was with me. And she had a tooth go bad in the restaurant on Friday night. So we go to the hospital, emergency hospital, and the first thing I notice at the emergency hospital is, and I'm just sharing a story. I'm not telling you anything about your life or what you should do or not do or how you should view things or not view things. I'm just sharing a story. Well, because I just started to think how I could hear this if I was sitting out there like I'm, you know, and I'm just sharing a story. And the very first thing I noticed at the hospital is that nobody gave a shit about insurance or money. Okay? Nobody cared. Everybody's focus was immediately on her and what could be done to alleviate the discomfort. That was like immediate. Nobody cared about it. It was never even discussed. Not by the nurses, not by the emergency room admitting nurse, not by the doctor who went out down the hallway, corralled an oral surgeon who he knew was seeing a patient who doesn't even work at the fucking hospital and brought him back so that he could look at her mouth for nothing just because he happened to be there, right? I'm from Los Angeles, which has not been my experience with emergency hospitals and doctors. They told her she'd have to see a dentist and it looked like the best thing she needed was a root canal. They have an emergency dental service in Santa Fe, which never answered the phone. The next morning, I'm telling the concierge at the hotel, we got to find a dentist who will come out on Saturday because this, I mean, it was like nobody even stopped for a second. I mean, the girl just shoved all her shit aside. Planning tours was not as important as getting this woman's mouth taken care of, right? And she devoted all of her time to finding a dentist and got one of the guys on the desk, the front desk, to help. Somebody there on the program got a dentist to call us to talk to her in the interview. Finally, we got a dentist who came out on Saturday. We went to his office, and he took care of her tooth. And I sat in the waiting room while he's talking to her because he knew she was very frightened, and he took 2 hours to do this emergency root canal because he went very slow. And he explained to her it would be a little more difficult because he didn't have his assistant, and, you know, so be patient. And, I mean, it was like, and I sat out in the waiting room, and I cried. Wasn't sure why I cried. I just cried because I wasn't used to the humanity. You know, I mean, I live right in the heart of Los Angeles. I mean, smack dab center, okay, where the hip, slick, cool shopping center is, and the new Four Seasons is going up, and the new Mamamasa is going up, and, you know, where you walk through the automobile stereo shop, and there's enough fucking money parked there to feed a nation, and, you know, I mean, that's where I live, right? So I come back, and I'm still not impressed with Santa Fe, intellectually. Big fucking deal. It's a little hot, it's a little high, it's hard to breathe, it's a little dusty. You know, the mind is always there to really see the beauty of the world, you know. So I come back to Los Angeles, and I'm back home 2 days, it's Tuesday, and the reality of my living in Los Angeles sets in. And what happened to me was, I became aware of all the insulation I had put around myself to keep me from feeling the reality of where I live and what the people are like and how they treat you and the expressions on their faces and how you're dealt with on a level as a consumer or as a patient or as anything else, you know, just how meaningless you really are. At least that's my perception of it, okay? And it's the perception I hid from myself. And I used to get confronted by people occasionally. And it used to really anger me. I'd be off like Oregon, right? Eugene, Oregon, talking. And after the meeting, somebody would come up to me who was maybe 15 years sober and ran maybe 20 miles a day and was a vegetarian and lean and looking good and feeling good and, you know, breathing clean air and drinking clean water. And out of love, not out of any kind of, they would say to me, God, as much as you care about these things, this exercise and nutrition and the consciousness, I've got to ask you, how can you live in Los Angeles? I said, well, my work is there, which is already putting something a little ahead of me. And we're not what we do, guys. We're not what we do. That's only what we do. I used to have a doctor who's a good friend of mine. Whenever anybody comes up to him in a social situation and asks him what he does, he says, about what? So now, I'm sitting there knowing I got to get out of L.A., do not have a penny to my name. Washington is the place I got to go. But this child is saying Santa Fe. I'm saying to the child, the mind is saying to the child, can't go to Santa Fe. The child's saying, I like the people in Santa Fe. You know? There are a lot of big kids in Santa Fe. And there are. A lot of the people who live in Santa Fe are the hippies who were in the communes in the late 60s and early 70s who got married, had children, and bought a house and got, you know, now they're employed and they're lawyers and dentists or doctors or, you know, one guy I adore, man. She had a heavyweight art background from the finest Eastern schools in New York, and she restores broken Indian pottery. I love it. I mean, what a trip. I can't believe, you know, she found where she wanted to be, and then she found out what she could do there, you know, in order to be there. And it's like, I mean, that's how I understand spiritual. But anyway, my mind is saying you can't go there. You can't move to Santa Fe. So now I go to Pendleton, Oregon to speak. One flight in a day, one flight out. The convention's over. I'm standing in this little airport waiting to leave. The guy comes off of the flight in. It looks vaguely familiar. Great look about him, sparkle in his eyes, about 55, healthy, kind of an outdoor farmer type, or, you know, just real healthy guy. He walks up to me and says, you're Bob Rowe? I said, yeah, why? He says, I heard you speak at the thing in Seaside, Oregon. He said, I really enjoy it. I said, God, what brings you to, you know, Pendleton? I couldn't understand why anybody would go to Pendleton. And so he said, my wife and I have been, you know, on a trip for about 6 weeks now looking for a place to settle, you know, looking for someplace else. He said, we've been in Santa Fe for 3 weeks. And he said, we've decided we're going to stay, so I'm just here to load the stuff in the truck and take off and go. So I'm walking out to the plane. See, I'm not stupid. I know Eskimos when I see them, right? But I'm walking out to the plane saying to God, oh, come on, you know? What the fuck is this, right? You know, I'm out here, you know, I don't have a penny. You're giving me road signs to Santa Fe. I can't buy the gas to go to Santa Fe, for Christ's sakes. You know, I'm supposed to be in Washington, you know? And And the following week, I had to go to Washington to speak, and I went to Washington, and I couldn't even get to the San Juan Islands. Everything, it was impossible. I could not get to the San Juan Islands to look. I mean, it's like, you know how, it was just one roadblock after another. I could not get there. Had a whole day to get there, and everything happened to keep me from getting there. So I'm home. I'm on the way home on the plane, I'm saying to God, you know, fun. Are we having a good time? You know? You know, are you having a nice day? Because I don't know where the fuck we're going or what we're doing here. But it's ceasing to be cute, you know? Because I've given notice where I live, okay? And the whole pole is this way, and I can't get there. But I decide in my heart that I know that's where I'm going. I know that's where I'm going. I don't know how I'm going. I know it's where I'm going. And I know I'm leaving my apartment because I've already given notice. And I don't know how any of this is going to... There is no way in hell that any of this can take place. Okay? 4 days later, I have to go in for my second bankruptcy hearing. I had a lot of problems in the first one, and I have to come back for a second one. And then eventually I have to go for a third one. Court's real interested in my residuals. Because it's an ongoing source of income. Of course, so is the IRS, and the court gets to take second seat to them. It's all, by the way, if I had another hour, I would tell you how you can be, you know, walking the spiritual path and because of old issues, ACA issues, wipe out your whole life. Just absolutely, financial irresponsibility is a big ACA issue, real heavy inability to take care of ourselves. Goes to all areas, including money, you know, it covers it all. So anyhow, I go to the court, I'm sitting there and I'm talking to the trustees interviewing me. He says, well, how much have you made so far this year in residuals? You know, I said, well, I made maybe $4,000 or $5,000. And I've given you a printout of all the, you know, residuals for 3 years so you can look at it yourself. And you can also see that it's a diminishing, you know, and it is, it's a diminishing thing. I go home, and the next day I'm like in a real bad place. I know God is in charge, and I'm reading my little pamphlet that says God is in charge and God is in control, you know. And I'm reading it all day long to remind myself God is in charge, and nothing makes sense. I'm going through the fucking bankruptcy, which I hate. I hated it more than anything else in the world. I tried to keep it off for 2 years, which was also insanity. And it's like, I mean, I was sending $75 payments to Chase Manhattan Bank in New York, and the interest was $76. So I'm taking $75 out of my pocket and going in debt another dollar. You know, I mean, that's... Right? But that's an ACA issue, right? Forget saying, I fucked up, and I'm going to have to start clean, and I'll get to you guys in a couple of years, you know, as soon as I rebuild. I had to, you know, don't want anybody to think Bobby's a bad boy and can't, you know, so Bobby eats less and, you know, lives like, you know. Anyhow, so that's how I'm sitting there at home, knowing I'm going to move. I have no money. God's giving me no answers, you know. The child is ecstatic. The child is very happy. The child's going to Santa Fe. Has not one care in the world. Not one. I mean, it was like he had no touch with reality at all. The rest of me is immersed in what I consider reality. No money, shit, we're screwed. And a guy was there visiting me. We were talking about a project, and I was just saying, how you feel? I said, I'm just bummed. You know, I'm just really goddamn depressed. You know, I'm just down. I'm really down. I got the tools. I don't know if I'm using the tools. I don't know where I'm at. I'm at the wall. I don't know what the hell is going to happen to me. I have no idea what the hell is going on here. And the phone rings. Now, the Writers Guild is our union for the writers, and it protects us, and it also it polices the residuals to make sure that when shows are in syndication, we're being paid our money. I mean, as much as they can. It's an impossible situation. It's a no-win situation. I had been telling the Writers Guild for a year that a specific producer, major producer of a major television show had been cheating us. See? And I was the only one calling them because I was the only one speaking who's going from city to city to city to city, and I turn on the fucking television set at night, and there'd be the show. I think, God, it's showing here, it's showing in New York, it's in Texas, it's in, you know, Montana, it's in fucking Vancouver, British Columbia, and where the hell is the check? You know? So I call the guild and say, we're getting had here, you know, and they ain't right. So I pick up the phone, and they say, well, we finally audited them. And you were right. And they owe you for three runs of every episode you wrote for them. Whoa. and we have the checks here. Would you like to come pick them up? Let me tell you the interesting thing about this. I'm a very honest person. I'm a truthful person and an honest person in all my affairs. And God knows that. And had they come the day before, I would have had to disclose them. I would have had to disclose them in the bankruptcy hearing and submit them to the court. Every penny. And it came the day after. They had had them the day before. They just didn't call me. So now, Lois and I, who are in the middle of a separate... Well, okay, here we go. Here's the best part. The spiritual person I've been talking to is the spirit. Do what you want with that one, okay? There's a guy who's pretty well, if you're into any of this stuff about spirits living on the other side, there's a guy by the name of Dr. Peebles who has appeared through channels, or what's called channels, all over the world and across the United States. Recently, he's been primarily between a guy in Palos Verdes and a guy in Arizona. And I went. Now, I've known since I was a child, two of my spirit guides, you can believe this stuff or not, so just, you know, whatever, you know, tune out if you think, you know, I've gone over the edge. It's quite okay. Two of my spirit guides are Indians and have been since I was a child, and they were there to protect me. And I have to say they've done a great job. Bottom line is, as I stand here this moment, they have not failed. I've learned a lot, and I'm still here. So I guess, you know, we've done okay. So I asked this spirit that I'm conversing with, I know you love this, right? I'm conversing with, and he's the one that was saying the things about enlightenment is lighten up, you know, and that you're only here but to learn. And he said one thing to me, he's really cute. I said, I write for television. He said, do you know what television is? He said, of course. He said, I love television. I said, I watch television all the time. He said, in fact, there's going to be an S channel before long. You know what that is? I said, yeah, sure, it's a spiritual channel. He said, right. He said, it'll be a frequency where you can see us. He said, but of course no one will believe it. He said, they will think it's some kind of special effect. Something created by people. But we'll have a good time anyway, you know? And I go with that, right? And I mean, and you can, this stuff is like, you know, whatever you want to do with it. That's, I gotta tell you, it's a very heavy experience, you know? Because you just watch a human being change before you. And something entirely new fill the room. Just completely fill the room. The energy is overwhelming. So I said, I talked about going to Santa Fe and this and that. And so he put me in touch, you know, really in touch with my guides and said, fine. You know, we won't tell you what to do, but go. Right? So now I know I'm supposed to go to Santa Fe, right? And it's like, okay, I got the money, I got the thing, and Lois and I have been in the process of the separation for like 2 months. And what we've been doing is honoring the friendship. I mean, we got all our feelings out of the way, and then we stayed another 12 weeks together to honor all those qualities in each other that we care about and to support each other in our own individual endeavors, which is really hard because I'm not used to that. I'm used to staying in a relationship until it's fucking dead and rotted so that you walk out and there's no feelings left. You know, I didn't understand that you could still have a lot of caring and a lot of feelings for someone and it's still not okay to be there. That it's not productive or at the right place at the right time or the right person. So there was a lot of pain and sadness, a lot. So we were just trying to be real supportive because that's come to be my concept of a decent relationship anyway, is the two parties involved are absolutely unconditionally supportive of the other person becoming the best person they can be. And if it takes them away, it takes them away. If it doesn't, it doesn't. But that's what you support. So we were doing that, and she was going to go to Florida for a few weeks and then on to back to Toronto where she lives. And I was going to drive her as far as New Orleans because she wouldn't have to drive that far alone, and then she could go on. And she said, well, look, as long as we've got to go to New Orleans anyway, why don't we take the time to take a couple extra days out on the trip, and we'll go to Santa Fe first, and I'll help you look for an apartment, and then you can take me on to New Orleans. I said, okay, great, we'll do that. It's amazing I feel safe enough to share this stuff here. Please don't share this stuff. except on a one-to-one with somebody, you know, where I have a sense of energy. So whatever you guys are putting out, I want you to know I really appreciate it because I feel safe. So, we're on the road. We're going to Santa Fe. So, we'll make the left turn out of Albuquerque and we head up toward Santa Fe. And we get about 20 minutes outside Santa Fe. And suddenly, over the mountains, Santa Fe sits in a valley and behind Santa Fe is the mountains. Over the mountains comes this incredible fucking storm. I'm talking like I have never, ever seen in my life. And all of the lightning is off to the right side of where we are. And it's like 4 and 8 bolts at a time down and 4 and 8 bolts at a time across. It was like a fucking light show. It was the most incredible thing I've ever seen. And all the clouds were wisps. They weren't solid. They weren't the traditional, you know, Midwestern solid black thunderstorm. Everything was sweeping like a brushstroke or like a spirit or like, you know, ethereal, right? And I'm in a storm and I'm like overwhelmed by the storm. I'm like, I can't understand what I'm feeling. All this lightning's crashing down. It was just incredible. Finally, I said to Lois, I said, well, now that I'm starting to really believe in some of this stuff, I'm almost tempted to say that the spirits in New Mexico are throwing the little welcome home party for Hawkeye and White Eagle, who are my spirit guides, right? And she turned to me and she said, maybe it's because they're bringing you home. And at that moment, at that second that she said the word home, this massive bolt of lightning struck next to the car on the road, like an exclamation point. And then when we got, and then I just started to sob, you know, this, like a child. Finally, he's going home. And when we pulled into town, it's like it was bathed in sun. You know, it was gone. It had passed. And, of course, needless to say, you know, I walked out, found an apartment, right? You know, I mean, it was not particularly difficult. I knew it was the first one I looked at, but I had to look a whole other day, you know. The kid says, this is it, this is great. You know, I spent another day with the paper and the map and... So I drive on to New Orleans and we say our goodbyes and she goes her way and I fly back to California and I load the stuff in the truck. It was great. I bought a truck that was too small. I had to leave a lot more stuff than I planned on leaving. And so I had to leave stuff like I packed the pillows for the couch, but the couch was in L.A. because I donated to a church and I had the pillows. You know, like, women call me up and say, it's nice and we really appreciate it, but can we have the pillows, you know? I said, oh God, they're in a box. You know, I forgot. I planned on bringing it, but I ran out of room. And so I could get everything loaded in the truck, and I get it all, you know, the little car in the back, and away I go, you know, and I'm going back, and then one more time, I make the left turn out of Albuquerque, and I head up to it. And as I come into town with my stuff, it's like the same storm comes back. And I've since talked with some psychic people who live in Santa Fe, and the relationship between the Indians and the land and the storms is incredible. And it is really a very spiritual thing. They don't see, like Peebles was saying, that the illusion is separation. It is an illusion. There is no separation. And they don't believe in that there. They believe that it's all connected, you know, and that the storms are as much a part of their spiritual life as another human being or as a plant or as that sensation of God inside. They see it all as a oneness, you know. And it's interesting that thousands of years ago, 2,000 years before Jesus, there was some little guys bopping around the planet called the Essenes. And they were prophets and they said that the true peace comes when you finally are at peace with Father God, intellect, intuition, and Mother Earth. And you are of your father and your mother. And that is what's meant by honor your father and mother. You honor your Father God and you honor your Mother Earth, who is giving you substance and technically life. And that you are of these two. Okay? And of course, the Indians hold that belief. So, I don't know what all that was about, but that brings you up to date on my life. I am happy as a little kid because I can... And the big joke is this. In the last 3 weeks in Santa Fe, I've done more work for television in L.A.
than I did the preceding year. The day I arrived to rent my apartment, the call came to do an episode for a show in L.A. I mean, it's like, you know, and I went there just willing to take the money I had and go, and that's it. Write what I want to write until the money came pouring in or ran out. Didn't matter. Didn't matter. Gone. Goodbye. There I am. So, what am I trying to say? I'm trying to say trust God. But understand, it's hard to do when you're not in supportive environments and you don't know how to be supportive of yourself. So the footwork we're doing here is learning to be supportive of ourselves. Find out who you are. It's not change who you are, it's find out who you are. You can correct things later. Later. It's find out who you are, because it's not a bad person. And one nice thing about the community I really like about I'm in is people are okay who they are. I think I've seen one Mercedes. You know, and yet there's a lot of money there. But it's not important to people. You know? Beg your pardon? People, if you go. I mean, people who live there have all come from other places. It's like they've been pulled in. People have come for a day and never left, sent for their shit by phone. You know? I mean, you run into people in town and you talk to them and the stories are incredible. Incredible. It's like this, you know. And other people walk through and see nothing. Now, this is the time of the year the town is wall-to-wall tourists. You know? And they don't, you know, they see it's a little hot and a little dusty, but the opera's nice, and there's a few museums, and a few nice artists, and a couple of photographers, and they like the Indian pottery, you know? And they go home. Other people are just like, you know, sucked right in. That's it, you know? Nowhere else they could possibly live. Okay. I can't think of anything... I'm trying to think of something really brilliant to close with, but I can't. That's nice. I'm glad I can't. Oh, dropped it. I can't remember the story. I mean, I vaguely remember about a guy in the ocean with a rock, and the people in the boat tell him to drop it, and he can't. He hangs on. And the rock, of course, is his old belief systems and his old ideas and everything he's worked so hard to develop. And he's drowning in the lake, and the guy in the boat kept saying, drop the rock. And he can't drop the rock because it's all he knows. It's what he has created over all these years of his life. And so he continues to sink because he can't let go of the rock. And the secret for all of us, of course, is drop the rock. You know, and that is, in essence, stated clearly in the book when it says all of our old ideas. It doesn't say bad ideas. It says all of our old ideas. And we have a lot of stuff we think is correct because we were taught it's correct. And it's incorrect. You know, so I have enjoyed being up here. This has been really good. This meeting went a lot longer this morning than I plan on going. And interestingly enough, it's not anything that I had wanted to say when I got up this morning. And I got to hit on this again because this is really important. It's important to me anyway. A lot of the stuff I shared this morning, I was able to share because of the atmosphere that you create. You created. I didn't bring it. You created it. You created an atmosphere of safety for me, okay? And now if you kind of like the feeling in the room right now, it is because at this moment, we are all in a supportive environment. This is what a supportive environment feels like. There's a little laughter, and there's some tears, and there's some crying, and there's some feeling, and there's some emotion, and there's some energy, and there's some questioning. This is in a supportive environment. This is what it feels like. May we always all do our best to be in one and be part of one. God bless you.